Welcome. I'm David Castro, board member of the Alliance of Leadership Fellows. Today, the Alliance is excited to bring you the first of a series of national conversations engaging leaders at the frontiers of social justice. Our conversation today is about racial equity in the culinary sector, which has a powerful influence over our entire food system in the United States. Talk That Walks is a series that convenes frontline leaders at the critical place where thought becomes change. The leaders in today's dialogue are at that vitally important transition point in their work, where experience and insight take flight as impactful action. We want to thank BCA Global, the Social Justice Initiative at Bryn Mawr College, and Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at the University of Utah for helping to produce today's critical conversation. To learn more about the vision and mission of the Alliance, visit us on the web at allianceofleadershipfellows.org. I'm passing the baton now to Alex Askew. Alex is an important leader in the sector that is our focus today. He's both a Kellogg Foundation National Racial Equity and Healing Fellow and a Castanea Fellow. Alex has years of experience and leadership on this important topic, and he'll be your guide for the rest of this event.
Well, thank you, David, and thank you to the Alliance of Leadership Fellows, the University of Utah, and all our constituents at BCA Global. We're honored and privileged, and I'm honored and privileged in moderating this national conversation for the very first time in racial equity in the culinary arts. You know, we have a list of distinguished panelists that I will get into introducing, and want to welcome everyone into this conversation, in as that I know that this is not a simple topic, but more of a complex topic, and one that I'm so glad, despite the series of events over the last year, that has put racial equity back on the menu. So as we look at cooking up social change and moving past the conversation towards some real actionable items, I first want to introduce myself. So I'm Chef Alex Askew, and I'm president of BCA Global. And our organization's mission is focused on reimagining racial equity in the culinary arts and food service industry. I'm a chef, I'm an activist, and I really believe in the thought process and thought leadership of systems change and radical change to create the environments necessary for everyone to be healthy and whole, where equity, racial equity is the lens that we look through. Before I introduce our distinguished panel, I just want to kind of set the construct for this conversation, because I think it's really, really important. I've sat in on many conversations over the last year in the food service space, and I'm a little taken aback that the main core issues of food justice and racial equity have not been highlighted. We want to take an approach that is based on a construct and a framework that is solid, in as that we move in a way of determining and defining the terms and the framework in which we will move forward in this conversation towards action. The first thing I want to just discuss is that the culinary industry controls 70% of the food system, and yet it's the last large segment that has been approached or challenged in terms of racial equity. Now, we can ask the whys and the why nots, but what we do know that between their workforce, their procurement, and the amount of people that are fed, the culinary food service industry needs one, has to be one that we look at and mindfully target as a way to create systemic change. You know, most of the leaders in the food space have unfortunately just checked the box. And these programs really have done little to create the change needed for racial equity to flourish and for everyone to have an equitable chance, especially people of color. I just want to read a statement that was brought to my attention just to illustrate and really lift what is being done right now that we need to look at changing. In terms of programming, equity should not be a program. Diversity, equity, and inclusion work cannot happen in a vacuum. It must be woven and stitched into daily practices at every level of the organization. To ensure that an organization is truly working towards racial equity and inclusion, all operations, policies, programs must be viewed through this lens. Equity work means that the whole organization must be brought into the concept of introspection, self-evaluation, and making changes to better align the organization with these values. Task force and subcommittees can only do so much in order to truly change organizational culture. In order for this to happen, the whole organization and its thought leaders has to participate in courageous conversations. So we need to move past this level of lack of authenticity in changing a problem that has been systemic for so long. And, you know, by doing that, we can actually create a better workplace environment. Equity inclusion has been shown as a business case for profitability, and also making sure that people can go to work and go home with a positive energy impacting families and communities. The next thing I want to do before we get into our conversation is just go through some definitions, because I really feel by defining things clearly, we have a better way of understanding what we're trying to do and what it means. In this particular conversation, we will deal with a framework that is based on several different principles that are very, very important. And I encourage everyone to take notes and start this, if it's not already included, in your glossary for racial equity work. The first thing you want to do is create a safe space. A safe space is an environment in which a person can feel confident that they will not be exposed, discriminated, criticized, harassed, or any other emotional harm. These spaces don't exist. I know it. I get constant calls and emails all the time with people saying, please don't say my name. I don't feel comfortable. I feel that there'll be some type of punitive damage if I speak up. That needs to be confronted, and that culture needs to change. The other piece of it is we need to create a brave space. And a brave space encourages mutual learning and accountability. We accept the likelihood that we will be in an uncomfortable conversation when we're investigating issues of race, privilege, oppression, and power. This is very, very important, because without a brave space, we cannot reach the heights of having the emotional, intelligent conversations we need to actually confront systemic racism. The other piece is equally important. We want to find accomplices and allies, but with the end goal of actually making sure we have accomplices. And let me just explain the difference. Being an ally is one of the first steps in race and social justice work. But an accomplice goes beyond advocacy. An accomplice uses their privilege to challenge existing conditions at the risk of their own comfort and well-being. We need accomplices in this work. A shared risk is necessary, combined with moral courage, for us to really have true systemic change in terms of racial equity in the larger system, the culinary and the food service industry. So that said, and that frame in mind, I want to invite everyone into this courageous conversation. And that, by definition, is one that is difficult, yet necessary. The goal is to have a common understanding through authentic communication. And that, my friends, is how I will segue and introduce our distinguished panel. And I'll go one by one with ladies first, Valerie Spain, a great advocate to the organization. And Valerie, before I get into your question, can you tell our audience what your personal mission statement is so they can get to know the essence of who you are?
Yeah, I'm an accomplice in this work. I'm dedicated and passionate about anti-racism work. And that's why I'm here, to be part of that.
That's great. Valerie, as being an anti-racist ally and accomplice of this work, and also being white, which I think is so important that this is a all-inclusive effort to actually confront systemic racism. You know, how's the overarching culinary space influence, and how can it be impacted by anti-racist work and play an important role?
Yeah. So first, thank you for inviting me to be part of this conversation to talk about anti-racism. You know, because in the United States, the culinary space, like every other sector in the United States, is rooted in white supremacy culture and capitalism. And the culinary arts owes a huge debt to the ingenuity and the creativity of enslaved and indigenous people. And part of anti-racist work in this space is knowing that history. And culinary schools have enormous power and influence in this space as well. They set the tone for what's taught, how it's taught, who teaches. And I take a minute to focus on the Culinary Institute of America because I was part of a team that you organized around CIA proposal. And you know what happened there is very illustrative of that, of a point. It really illustrates a point because after George Floyd's murder, President Ryan published a statement in solidarity, and Chef Alex responded by outlining a partnership with very clear goals to help CIA do authentic anti-racist work at the school. And initial conversations were very positive. We were invited to submit a comprehensive proposal, but after several months, energy waned, their energy actually waned. And we received that final email that said, we're gonna take this work in-house. And because of economic constraints of the pandemic, we don't have money to invest in this proposal. And again, like a lot of institutions, it's easier to bring the work in-house because then you can control the work and the message. And you can make solidarity statements rather than engage in the hard work of becoming anti-racist, because it would mean, changing a white supremacist culture and system. And, the way I think of anti-racism work is really around connecting and naming. So conversations like this are a response to that. And even though people say, there's too much talk, I really feel like there's talk and there's conversation. There's saying you believe in something, but then there's, what we're trying to do here. There's this authentic, vulnerable conversation that always has potential for change when you have conversations that connect people. And it isn't just about talking, obviously. It's about institutions actively working to dismantle systems of oppression, treat workers fairly, use diverse supply chains, diversify their workforce, including leaders, including faculty. And there are a lot of best practices for people to do that. And people like us, we have the power to purchase from those organizations who do those things. And when they don't, we can protest, we can boycott, we can show them that, they're not worthy of our investment. And another aspect of anti-racism work here is also is personal. It's educating ourselves. It's learning how to manage our reactions so we can listen and talk. And to speak directly to white people for a minute, you know, if you're white, part of our work is talking to other white people. It's learning how to have those, you know, it's learning those basic skills to be, to have those uncomfortable conversations with other white folks, your friends, your family, you know, and then, and I like to say, now that I've gotten to know you better, you know, like share a meal with people, because sharing a food is a building block for changing culture. And like, we need an alternative to white supremacy culture. You know, white supremacy is a culture. It has symbols and language and places for people to belong. We won't change people just with facts, though facts are very important. History is very important. Or by telling people that they're wrong. You know, we need to envision and create a culture, which is, I really feel like what you're doing here, what the, you know, this beloved anti-racist community that we're nourishing in this space is about.
Wow, well said. Any brief comments from Chef Kabui or Chef Adan?
Chef Adan, do you want to say something?
Well, I want to apologize to everyone because I live in Houston and there's a big storm coming through and we just had a big thunderstorm and we have a power failure in Houston. That's why I'm going through all of this. I was all set up in my little studio and then I have to use my iPhone and go somewhere else. We have no light, we have no electricity. So I'm sorry, I apologize for the distraction of the video. Please, Chef Kabui, continue.
Thank you. I'm sorry to hear that you're in the middle of the storm, and we feel for you. I feel for you. I know how it's like. I've been there. So yeah. So accept our support for you. Yes. I just want to say that as the issue of race is not entirely new, because I came from a country colonized and by the British, and these issues are still prevalent. And as also a student of history, it really puzzles me to point as far back as the time of the Greeks. These issues that we are talking about were prevalent. There were conflicting interests, and in specific, I'm remembering the play by Aristophanes, 421 BC. 421 BC is 2400 years. And very interesting story to respond to Valerie, that in 421, Aristophanes wrote a story about peace, which was during a time of the Peloponnesian War, the war between the Athens and Sparta. And they were finally getting ready to sign a peace treaty. One guy became very, very popular, Tiresias. And he became popular because he was supported by the farmers. Why was he supported by the farmers? Because the farmers realized that the people, the populist president who was pro-war was benefiting from war. So people are suffering, few people are benefiting. It's the same thing we are having today. So Tiresias, funny story, created this big dung beetle that took him to heaven to find out why the God of peace was not having his soil. Only to realize that the God of war had buried the God of peace in a pit, and he rescued the God of peace. Literally, when I listen to Valerie, that's the image that comes to mind. We are here trying to unbury the God of justice, who has been buried by the gods of capitalism and what? Injustice, exploitation. That's all I have to say. I like to tell stories, as my friend and brother, Chef Ask, you know. This story is so painful sometimes to give the figures and stuff. So maybe telling short stories like that can illustrate why everybody need to be part of this. America is based on the idea of democracy from the Greeks. So that's why I went as far as the Greeks to say, let's look at the foundation of this country, going back to the people we borrow the idea on which this country is founded on. And the Greeks were having the same problems. Hopefully we can learn and not have this, to create this dung beetle that will take us to heaven to rescue the God of peace. They had to go to heaven. We don't have to go to heaven. We can do that now by creating alliances as we are across racial lines, gender lines, and forgetting all the small things that divide us, but keeping our eyes on the prize. Thank you.
So on that note, Chef Kabui, can you please introduce yourself and give a personal mission statement before I ask you to just briefly talk about power and oppression in this equation?
Thank you very much, Chef Askew, and thank you very much again for the illustrious panel that you've assembled, and especially a big shout out to BCA Global and the University of Utah for taking these bold steps to do what is just right and what is long overdue. My name again is Chef Kabui, and I was born in Kenya. I've been living in the US for the last 3 decades. And my personal mission statement is to increase food literacy for the sake of solving the major global crisis that we have on the foundation of equity. Cannot have anything else if we don't do it with justice or with equity in mind. This country has been built on inequity, and one of the most convenient places to start is to deal with food, because food is something that connects all of us. So that's my mission statement.
Thank you. And would you just like to make a comment about oppression and power in the equation of racial equity in the culinary arts? And if you can, just keep this to a couple of minutes so we can kind of stay on time.
Sure, thank you. Yes, again, it seems like I already introduced my position, but yeah, when I think about the conversation today, I'm reminded of the many people who have gone before us and on whose shoulders we stand. And the story hasn't been pretty. The road hasn't been easy. Hasn't been a big yellow brick road, as we find in the play Wizard of Oz, but has been really, really raucous one. So I probably like to start by saying that Dr. King, who was one of the biggest luminaries who has inspired the work of mindful eating for the beloved community, in his last sermon in Atlanta, Georgia, right before he was assassinated, talked about something that I found very, very unique in his oratory skills and in his philosophy. He talked about the God of history. And that concept has kind of lingered in my mind as we're having this conversation sitting here, because I had never heard Dr. King in his many speeches and sermons talking about the God of history. When you talk about God, you know, the concept of God is just one concept of God. If you're a Christian, then it's one concept. But he specifically talked about the God of history. And what he was saying is that during that time, America was in the war with Vietnam, and the American government was spending $500,000, $500,000 to kill one Viet Cong, to kill one of the quote unquote American enemies. But yet it was spending a paltry $80 per person who was considered poor at that time. Now, how is it, as I say, when I refer to Aristophanes, that America always find money to go to war? 9/11 comes, America goes in debt to fund the war. During the even current administration, previous administrations, the story has been the same. There's always money to go to war, always money to go to war, but no money to help the social programs or fund the social program that can uplift people from poverty and deal with issues of equity. We are now going to have a strong country when half of them or large part of the country is living in abject poverty. And we can continue the same story as the doctor and or be at the same spot where Dr. Martin Luther King was talking about the campaign against poverty. And that ended nowhere when Coretta Scott King and the other people who came behind after he passed away or took up the baton, they went and ran out of Washington, D.C., trying to campaign for people who didn't have any means. So if they didn't do it now, we can fall for the same political subterfuge that they fell for in those times. So we have to work. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So last but not least, one of my favorite new friends, Chef Adan Medrano, who we've had some really great conversations, and I really appreciate them. Let's talk about you. What's your personal mission statement? Give our audience a little taste of your personal essence so they can get to know you. And then I'll ask you a question as well that you can help the audience bring some light to in a particular special arena in racial equity in the culinary and food service industry. So please, Chef.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Chef Alex. I appreciate the conversation so far, especially the ideas about so many have gone before us and the ideas of being detailed and memorable in what we do that Valerie said. My name is Adan Medrano, as you see. I'm in Houston. We have a power outage. I'm using my phone. And I am a food writer, a filmmaker, and a chef. I trained at the Culinary Institute of America, as did Chef Alex. And I believe that cooking is about making beautiful food. And the beautiful food that I delve into is the indigenous Native American food of Texas and the Americas more broadly. That's what I write about. That's what I cook. And I believe that food narrates who we are. Every time that we cook and we share food, we are narrating our identity. We are recalling our memory and we are building community. And those facets of cooking, I love, I enjoy. And when we meet up against the systems in restaurant industry, in the movie industry, in the United States and society in general, that put barriers in front of people because they are people of color. Mm. And because of our histories, that is a struggle that needs to be had because we have to enjoy beautiful food. And that's the way you make beautiful food, by overcoming those. So that's a little bit of who I am.
Right. And, you know, there is a large role that media plays. And you have a vast amount of experience in that segment of media. What are the strategies that need to be implemented, employed, deployed to have media and the world stage understand their accountability?
Great, thank you. I will take a media question. Media and food are a love of mine, two passions of mine. And the fact that Latinos, Latinx people, and all people of color, Blacks, Native Americans are underrepresented is of course a big problem and struggle, one that has been going on for a long time. I'm glad that the University of Utah has this department and activity for addressing that. The Berkeley Media Studies Group is also doing that. Public Media for All. There are many groups, and as Valerie so wonderfully explained, that their programs do have to do with conferences and activities that you can undertake. I want to celebrate those because we have been doing them and we have been gaining ground, not enough. We have so far to go. But what I would like to do in terms of those, that is, what media strategies could we undertake? I would like to go under that and say that underneath the tactics of boycotts, letter campaigns, which are all wonderful, is the power of our narrative. It is the power of our stories of who we are as Native Americans, Black Americans, Indigenous, Mexican Americans, Latinx. It is the power of our belonging that really is the strength for all of these. And we are getting stronger. And that's why in the public sector, you are seeing more of our stories. It's not because we are being done a favor by the media. It is because, as Chef Kabui said just a while ago, we are stepping on the ground that has been built by people before us. The martyrdom of George Floyd, the blood and sweat that has been gained by many of our ancestors who died and struggled for this. We are standing on their shoulders, and that's why we have more stories, not enough, but more. We have High on the Hog, that series on Netflix about the Black American experience and how it forms the US food in America. My film, which is also up there. And the reason we are doing those things is because of the work that has gone before. And what I want to talk about is because our cooking is strong and it's gaining ground. What do I mean by that? When one of my earliest memories, I'm talking about memory, identity, and community. One of my earliest memories, I was 5 years old, and I remember it. Oh, excuse me, I've got to make sure the timer is on. I was in a corner of the kitchen, and she reached out to me, and she gave me a warm, steamy corn tortilla. She had taken it, sprinkled droplets of water as though she were sprinkling fairy dust, and then she rolled it up real tight and she gave it to me. I tasted this roasted corn, moist roasted corn, the aroma, and then her actually giving it to me. This is formative. This is narrating. She was telling me who I am, and I remember these things. That's the power of food. And amidst the dispossession, because I am a Coahuiltecan person, my family and my ancestors have been in Texas and northeastern Mexico. It's the region that's called the Coahuiltecan region, the Texas-Mexican region. Our ancestors first came here 15,000 years ago. We have been living here that long, over 400 generations. And our stories were erased from the public media, but they existed inside the intimacy of our homes because of the work of mainly women. And amidst oppression, dispossession, the spaces of food intimacy continue today, and that's where we find our power. That's why it's growing more. And the main thing about this power is that we know that we were poor. I was a migrant farm worker. My hands got bloody from picking cotton. I know what it is to be hungry and to be thirsty, but my mother would cook these meals with chile, arroz con pollo, rice, aguacate, these tortillas made with flour or corn. And we understood, or she as a culinary artist understood, it's necessary that we survive. Of course we have to eat, but the important thing is not that we survive. It's how we survive. We survive with beauty, nourishment, sustainability. All of these things are a necessary component of our aesthetic culture. And that's what we're narrating. And these are the stories, these are the values that are inside our families, all of our families, and they grow. And an example is the Tex-Mex. Tex-Mex is what everyone knows is very popular. That's not our food. Our food is Texas Mexican comida casera, home cooking of the Mexican-American indigenous women who over centuries kept us alive and kept our memories alive. That it's carne asada. And forget about the cheese, you know, enough with the cheese. That is not the way we eat at home. So that's a story of our food that was erased, but it hasn't been erased in our homes. We're still cooking. We may have been dispossessed. We may have lost our lands and access to those foods that we used to gather so freely, but we're still cooking. And so I would say that the advances in the media that we have had, which are to be celebrated, they show us the way to the future as we get stronger. But the strength of those stories come from the stories of dispossession from which we found nobility and strength and beauty. And I would say to the media producers, to everyone who is an artist, a media artist, I'm a filmmaker. I would like to talk to my friends, chef artists and media artists, that ask yourself about how you are cooking your food as you cook either Mexican food or Native American food or African American food or any food. Do you have an aesthetic of justice? And I would say that the final question for you as a chef, a culinary artist or a film artist, you're trying to make something beautiful as I am. We are trying to give beautiful food to the world. And the more we do this, the more beautiful the world will be and the more peaceful. And so I would say to ask yourself this question about the beauty that you're trying to create. Can you have beauty without justice?
That was really beautiful. And, you know, you told me the, and we have a couple of minutes now. I just think it's really important to share the brief history of Babakola. And could you just give, you know, our audience, because as a culinary professional, you know, a lot of the cultural foods that, you know, are interwoven in the oppression, the cultural oppression, has survival imprinted in its DNA. Can you just give that beautiful description and brief history lesson on Babakola for our audience, please?
Yes, thank you for asking that. And this echoes what Valerie and Chef Kabul were saying earlier. The Barbacoa echoes that, you know, dispossession. Right now, we are seeing Barbacoa. The Washington Post just wrote about it. This restaurant, high-end restaurant, is serving it. Chefs are serving it as a delicacy, as a delicious dish, as they should. I urge the restaurateurs to not forget the story. Food always has a story. Mm-hmm. And if you own a restaurant, the story is part of the food. Mm-hmm. The barbacoa is a cow's head that's cooked in the ground for 12 hours. I have a recipe now where you smoke it and then put it in the oven because restaurants are not allowed to dig holes in the backyard, but that's what we had to do. When the cows came in the 1600s, the cows came to Texas. They killed the deer so that they killed the bison. And when they had all the meat from the cow, they threw away the head. And that's all we had because we were the poorest of the poor. We took the head and the culinary artists created this dish, which is now called barbacoa, by cooking it in earth ovens. Earth ovens are big technology that goes back 10,000 years, created by women. Women engineered earth ovens. And now this, in our film, we have this big scene of the barbacoa being taken out of the hole. And it's not just beauty, but it's how community is formed, how we strengthened ourselves by knowing how to deal with food in beautiful ways and confronting injustice. So that's a beautiful story. I'm so glad you asked that. I'm sure that Najati or Valerie might want to say something about this because they have experiences about this. This, the food of the dispossessed, poor people's food, out of our injustice and suffering comes beauty and strength. That's why we're still here. Mm-hmm. I'm not enjoying how we're here, because we're suffering, but I'm saying we're still here. Thank you for asking that.
No, that stuck in my mind, especially as you framed it as a survival food. And
that's it, yes.
And you also framed that the intention was genocide. And, you know, the strategy was if we get rid of their food source, that we can extinguish these people.
And I would like, in my new book, I annotate that with actual clippings from the newspaper in Austin, Texas, that says, letters to the editor, let us kill off the bison, because once the bison is gone, the red man will be gone.
Right. And so many other similar oppressive stories where survival was really at the DNA of why we are here today. Jeff, what is the name of your new book?
My most recent book is called Don't Count the Tortillas, The Art of Texas Mexican Cooking. It comes from my mom's dicho saying, las tortillas no se cuentan. When you have company coming in, don't count the tortillas, just share. Don't count the tortillas.
That's great. So we're going to have a few minutes. Please enter any questions in the chat. We're actually on, which is a very, very good thing. I'm going to go do a round robin of asking one really pertinent question for each of our panelists. I want them to think of, what is the secret sauce? Well, I'm a chef, so I have to speak in culinary terms. What is the secret sauce? What is the actionable item that we need to put in place today to impact change for tomorrow? And, you know, part of the frame we've talked about individually and collectively is that, you know, we can't reward racists for being racist. There needs to be a consequence for racism where they're deemed non-worthy of investment, whether that's a partnership, collaboration, sponsorship, investment, what have you. And we also need to, I have a five-year-old, reward good behavior. And we need to get those lines very, very straight. So I'll ask that question. In the meantime, I just want to kind of give people an overview of the core constructs of mindful eating for the beloved community and setting this table for social change. You know, 5 years ago when I was a Kellogg Fellow and had the privilege of David Castro as my systems thinking coach, and I had a mindfulness coach, Chris Block, and I actually signed up for every coach. I was very aggressive about having a fellowship. And we toured 22 cities, and I realized that, you know, in order for there to be real system change in the food system, there was a couple of things that needed to be done. You know, one is we needed to adapt this framework of mindfulness and mindful eating, which quite frankly did not have a lot of people of color involved. But looking at the constructs of mindfulness and being aware of your own self, being aware of your own body, being aware of where food comes from, who prepared the food, who touched the food, how it got there. I worked with a Native American chef, Walter Whitewater, many years ago, and just the way he touched the tomatoes and the fish. And he said, you know, these things are sacred and we're going to put them inside of our body. Why would you want to mistreat them? And understanding all of these root causes and having a mindfulness, mindful eating, you know, kind of a spirituality in our lives, I thought would be the perfect framework for food, race, and social justice, combined with Martin Luther King Jr.'s work of over 50 years ago of the beloved community. And as health equity, although he was known for civil rights, was on the top of his agenda, knowing that unless we had a healthy community, we could not have a productive and vibrant community. And so we look at all of this and we can call it justice, but at the end of the day, I think we call it human decency. And, you know, one of the things that I was reminded of is that slavery was so bad, not just because of the people enslaved, but the people that actually bought those products, knowing that they were coming from the backs of enslaved people. Imagine buying a shirt today and the label said, made in a child's concentration camp. I mean, we have made some progress, but this progress is still a base hit on the home run needed for total racial equity and social justice in our community. So Mindful Eating for the Beloved Community is this framework, and we have several programs that have had dynamic impact and change. We're changing chefs of color as them being health ambassadors and health equity thought leaders and food systems. And that fellowship is being funded by the Hilton Effect Foundation. So we're very, very proud of that. We have local programming that really focuses on understanding the whole food system and understanding that, you know, the labels that you can't read might not have the best things in them for you, and how we can bring at least some form of food literacy into the families and homes that unfortunately do not know how the food and, you know, lack of access to food really creates a negative impact on the children and their future in education and living a productive life. So with those 2 cents, let's get back into, you know, our questions from our audience, which they're coming up in the chat, but let's kind of sprinkle these questions in between our panelists' final words of action, secret sauce, power words, and encouragement. Valerie, what would you say, or is that action fulcrum that we need to keep in mind and make sure that our audience leaves with and can put it to use today?
Yeah, thank you. You know, I was originally interested in your work, Alex, because it was this, because you had this combination of mindfulness and this interest in food justice, which is the background for my work too. And I would really say, you know, sort of some combination of action, like really knowing this whole idea of knowing where our food comes from, and understanding those systems and trying to begin investing in the systems that we want and the people that we want and divesting ourselves from the systems that are oppressing. And that takes a while because we're sort of in the middle of it, but to do the best we can and to constantly be learning. And to also, I really feel like it's very important to understand that food is sacred. I'm always impressed by what Chef Adan says with Chef Kabuli and yourself talking about food as a sacred, preparing food as sacred, sharing food as sacred. Like, what if we actually thought that, you know, what if we actually acted from that place? We wouldn't, you know, we would be honoring each other and to constantly think about the ethics of what we're doing. Yeah, that's what I would say for the most part, for upfront for now.
Thank you. And I have to ask, what do you feel the role of that white person is in this work?
Yeah, to wake up, to start, you know, my work around coaching and consulting with folks and, you know, co-facilitating anti-racist affinity groups for white people, working directly with white people is, you know, stop worrying about discomfort and start worrying about being, you know, what's the good and right thing to do. And to speak up, and doesn't matter, you know, just start speaking, start talking, find other white people who agree with, who, you know, understand the ethics of this and the rightness of it, and start connecting. That's another thing I do, really trying to connect white folks around this issue and around the anti-racism work. So, and I just want to say a quick little thing. When Chef Adan was talking about his family history around food, you know, my background, I came from a working class background, and my grandmother and grandfather, my mother's side, my grandfather was Italian, my grandmother was Scottish, but I really identified with my Scottish grandmother, and she was very much a child of the Depression. She lived through the Depression. And so her scones and these various things she made, which were super simple, you know, like lard and flour and salt, like I remember those things. And I think connecting again with, you know, white folks can connect with their background, with their families. They don't have to go looking elsewhere for connections and family. They can go and look in their own families and find those connections. So,
thank you very much. So Chef Kabuli, I'm gonna ask you the same question, but I want you to kind of integrate the question from the chat. You know, we have all of these gestures towards racial equity, recent Juneteenth, which a lot of discussion is around that. You know, how can we move from gestures to real change? We have to, do we, you know, acknowledge these gestures as just being a small movement in the large movement, you know, or do we, what is the strategy? I'll let you answer that. What do you think the strategy is? I personally feel a base hit is a base hit. There is some applause, but that is not a home run for justice. And so, but what do you have to say in terms of weighing in on that?
Yeah, thank you very much for a guest who asked the question. Also, I probably should have taken a minute to just introduce myself, and I really appreciate that my partner Valerie, Chef Adan, have done that so that they know, so people know exactly what work the panelists are doing. And as a way, which is also part of a way of answering the questions about things we can do. So I do write about food as well. I do urban farming, I do grow food, issues and issues of equity and issues of eating well. But I'm also in the process of opening a food literacy in my village where I was born. And that's the land that I inherited from my father. And the food literacy center will be a center that will deal with all matters food. So my way of giving back to my community that also taught me so much, but also a way of me taking the privileges that I have simply because I'm Black and living in a country that is based on systemic racism. That doesn't mean that all Black people are equal or all Black people have the same abilities and capabilities or skills. So mine is, I know about food. That's what I learned. That's what I spent a lot of time in. From my young days, my teenage years, you know, I lived in on a farm with my mother. I owned a restaurant. And then I was privileged enough to come to the US and study at some prestigious institutions and under very, very intelligent people in those institutions. So for that, I'm also giving back. So back to the question about what is the connection that our guest wanted to know? What's the connection between food, racial equity, and activism? I go back to history where I grew up. Where I grew up, I come from an ethnic group called the Kikuyu. And amongst the Kikuyu, there was walking highways that connected different villages. And when you walk from one village to the next, whenever you get to the next from one village, whenever you get to the next to a village, on the walking highway, you'd find in many places a granary, which was called the granary of the deity that the Kikuyu worship, called Ngai, or the granary of, we probably say in English, the granary of God. And in that granary, the people of that village would bring food there every morning so that the people who are walking will get food for free. They'll just stop by, eat the food. So here you have a people who are considered savages by the missionaries that they need to be taught. You know, and I'm also mindful, and I also remember the word that is very, very hurtful that applies to the Native American: kill the Indian and save the man. So that was only relative to the U.S. in the U.S., but we had the similar thing in Africa, where the missionaries want to conduct a cultural genocide. They baptized the people there because the names were not good enough. The food that people, indigenous people are eating was considered inferior, and so on and so on. So what do? I look back at where I came from, where people believe food was a right that everybody had to have. You didn't have to be a friend. You didn't have to be an enemy. But everybody who is peaceful, whether you know them or not, they cannot be human, and neither can you, if everybody is not eating. I'll finish by telling a quick story because my brother is from the Caribbean, Chef Aski. The issue of equity is not only common to humans. There is a fish called the hamlet in the island, which are close by in the Caribbean. That fish is both male and female. It produces eggs and sperms. So that fish does not need to mate with anybody else, with any other fish. It can feed by itself. But the fish knows that the egg takes more energy to produce than the sperm. Because of genetic vitality, this fish will still mate with other fish. But whenever they mate with other fish, they have an agreement that you have to share an equal amount of eggs between the two. So you can give all sperms and get all eggs. So if the fishes can think enough that they need to share equally, I don't know why we think as human beings, we don't have the capacity to share equally. Unless we are lower than animals, we have the capacity to share equally. That we do, or we are not human. So we have to choose. We are either human, we are either superior, or we are not. But we can have it both ways. We can steal from labor from people. We can have other people living hungry and then think we are going to feel good about ourselves or we're going to survive long enough. That's all I'll pose that and let Barry and I.
Well, thank you, Chef Kabui. That's a story I haven't heard from your repertoire library. Chef Adan, can you close us out with your reflections of what needs to be done? We've talked about boycotts. We talked about consequences. We've also talked about, you know, bringing people that could be encouraged and saved into the movement. So you have a multi-pronged approach. Could you explain your strategy, which I think a lot of people would think it's relevant to this conversation as well.
Okay, okay. I'll build on what Valerie and Najathi spoke. You know, their strategic and then the importance of thinking through this equity. And so among the things that I do, and I collaborate with others, is the main idea that we are all human beings, as has been said here. You know, unfortunately our story has been erased. It has been erased from textbooks, from history books. And so I would say three things. One, just for that area, reclaim our story. Have the confidence to believe in and trust your individual experience as a person of color and that of our community. Claim that. We don't need historians from Europe or other to tell us who we are. We know who we are. Have the confidence to claim that, and from there your story comes. And then write the recipes. You have recipes. Get them from your grandparents. Write them down. We can write our own history. And I would say that interview them, and if you have a recording device, interview your grandparents and ask them to tell their story right there on tape. And then after we reclaim and have the confidence, I would say, know that this path that you mentioned, the beloved community, the basic difference with our eating and enjoying our food with beauty and with justice is this beloved community idea. And it goes against the model, the survival of the fittest. That's the economic model. The art of food is not about the survival of the fittest. Ultimately, it's about the survival of the finest of all of us as human beings.
Thank you so much. And thank you everyone for your questions. We're going to be rebroadcasting and have mechanisms to continue this conversation. So this is not by any means a one or done. And we are also encouraging people to actually, you know, take notes and really join the movement, because this is about building a collective. And unless we have a convergence of these ideas, a convergence of decency and a convergence of equity, we're not going to have a convergence on changing the conditions that lead to accountability and ultimately justice. So that said, we're going to leave with some departing words from our beautiful collaborative partnership with the Alliance of Leadership Fellows and the University of Utah. This is Alex Askew, president of BCA Global, bcaglobal.org, reimagining racial equity in the culinary arts and the food service industry. Goodbye for now, to be continued. Thank you.
On behalf of the Alliance of Leadership Fellows, thank you for joining us today. You'll be receiving an email from us shortly with guidance on how to become active and engaged in the work discussed in today's dialogue. We'll also tell you how to join the Alliance and ask you for your feedback about today's event. Please stay tuned for more dialogues in the Talk That Walks series in the coming months.